I'm Alexa. I used to work at DeepMind as a research engineer. I'm now building non-English large language models and building a company around that. And I don't like to drink my coffee. I'm basically a tea person because I get too hyperactive and anxious if I drink a lot of coffee. So that's that.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to the MLOps Community Podcast. I am your host, Dimitri Ose. And today, what a conversation. My man brought the heat. I am absolutely jazzed. Gassed up, if you will, after this conversation, because at the end, we talked all about why he is deciding to start something right now, why he decided to leave Microsoft and DeepMind and turn away offers that give him the opportunity to make millions of dollars from these big tech companies, since he is a bit of a figure out there in the ML research world. And he says, you know what? No. I want to do my own thing, and I think I have got the ability and the know-how to make that happen. So it made me remember a quote that I just heard, and it inspired me also, so I'm going to just say it, and I'm going to paraphrase it right now, so don't expect perfect accuracy on this quote, but it made me think about something that I heard, which almost in one way kind of shatters my soul a little bit. On the other way, it is incredible and it makes me amped. And that is, you're never going to be 17 again. You're never going to be 25 again. You're never going to be as young as you are right now. So it just makes me hear that and think, damn, I got to take advantage of it. Let's go. Let's go do it. This conversation at the end, it jazzed me up in that way too. I am stoked. We also got into so many other things, one of which being how he's getting all kinds of free GPUs. There's a GPU scarcity out there right now, and he's getting free GPUs. What has he got going on? Also, the kind of synchronicities and happenstances that have happened since he started putting out content on social networks. And last but not least, we go into languages and what he's working on right now with YugoGPT, a large language model that he's been training, and why he feels that it is important. Hope you enjoy it just as much as I did, and let me know if you're jazzed after the ending as I was. Am, really.
The humming of the GPUs.
Have you ever thought about making a song with those as your bass notes? You can just pitch them down.
I actually did. I commented, I think I tweeted out yesterday that, like, imagine visualizing a training of 10,000 GPUs and visualizing the gradient flows and then, like, making a music out of it. Like, I'm fairly sure there's going to be a ton of creative expressions, like, in visualizing these big systems, these godlike artifacts.
Oh my God, so much. And it's cool. It's a little inspiration to keep us going. But I get the feeling that when I hear your GPUs, I'm like, wonder if we could just sample that and then pitch it down and we use them as some bass notes. And there's our synth that we've got. And so I may try and come up with a little song from your GPU buzzing. But give us the story. Why do you have these GPUs here, and what have you been doing on them?
Yeah, so I've been training a ton of models. I think the first thing that I needed it for was Whisper, basically the model from OpenAI, to transcribe some of the audio, because I've been building these applications like Huberman transcripts. I don't know if you saw that one. Basically, I took the whole podcast from Huberman and then transcribed everything and created like these like websites where you can just search, look through the summaries and stuff, like, so that was the idea. But I don't know, like, also just aesthetically, I think having GPUs is a thing. Like, I like them really as an artifact in of itself, not just for its utility, but like, I've been definitely training models for various projects I've been doing on these two. But yeah,
all right, so now is the time where we're gonna ask the listener to place a bet. Does your computer setup consist of neon lighting or not? We're just going to ask the listener and then we'll have you answer in 3, 2, 1. What is it? Does it have some neon lighting in there?
Is it even a rig if it doesn't have neon lighting? I mean, by neon lighting, you probably mean RGB. Yep. I do have some, and it's like very configurable, but like I'm on Ubuntu currently, and the software sucks for configuring everything. But on Windows, I can literally tweak every single light there, and there is a ton. Like four RAMs, I have 120 gigabytes of RAM. Like each of them has like RGB lighting. Then I have like six fans. All of those have RGB lightings. I have like a water cooling for the CPU. Those have lighting as well. The motherboard itself has lighting, and then two GPUs have some lighting. So it's kind of fairly,
Maybe take a picture of it and then we'll overlay it on the YouTube video, because that will be cool to look at. And what are the GPUs that you've got? I don't think you mentioned it. You mentioned it to me before we hit record, but
I have two RTX 3090. I got one from NVIDIA actually as a present. Well, back while I was still in London. That's the perk of having some social media like presence. So I got a very nice GPU from them. And then the second one I bought actually here in Serbia because I needed more VRAM. And it was super cheap. Like it was actually, I think, around 750 euros or something. So like it was a steal. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
why
it's
did
a new
you
one.
Need more? Yeah. Cool. Why did you need more VRAM?
That's a question you don't ask a person in deep learning. You always need more GPUs. You always need more VRAM.
Have enough.
Yeah, like first of all, I wanted to parallelize like Whisper execution, so I was running like initially just a single model, then I transitioned to using something that's a bit more optimal in terms of inference, and so I could stack like four Whisper models, large ones. That's like, I don't remember how many billions of parameters it has, but like it's the largest one before the V3 version, Then the second one just added 2x the number of Whispers, so it was basically to just improve the throughput of like transcriptions. That's how I started, but yeah.
And so this was for these podcast transcriptions. How long did it take you to do the whole backlog of Huberman's podcasts? Because they're like 3-hour long podcasts.
Yeah, actually, only for the thing is, like, when I left DeepMind, we can speak about that. Like, I built this MVP of an application that's kind of like a Chrome extension that you install when you're watching your YouTube videos. And so on the side, you can kind of communicate with the video. And so for that project, I had to transcribe, I think, 40 channels. And some of them are much bigger than Huberman. Like, you might be surprised, but like, I for example, the what's the name of the guy? Jocko Willing, right? Jocko podcast.
Jocko's
he has like
problems.
A ton of content. Like, he has the most content out there. And like, it took a while to transcribe all of that. But yeah. And also like stuff like MIT OpenCourseWare has 8,000 plus videos. So it did require a lot of GPUs.
Oh man. So basically start to finish for these, you can expect what with your rig doubling the throughput, you've got, let's say 500 or 1,000 hours. You're looking at how long?
It was much faster than real time, but I would maybe for an hour of content, maybe you need a couple of minutes or less. Like it's fairly fast now at this point. I'm using this library called C Translate, which basically hyper optimized memory and like speed. It was made by like a single developer, as these things usually go. And that guy ended up in Apple recently, so like he was a single developer building that. That was like the fastest inference engine out there. So it was crazy.
What else did you do to optimize?
Multi-processing mostly, so like just running stuff in parallel combined with that, like not a lot honestly. There was a shit ton of work to be done on the side of just like dealing with vector databases, doing some post-processing, putting everything in the databases, and then setting up the full infrastructure, how to serve the when the user requests something from YouTube and get the served like response. Like that whole system is kind of where the complication lies in, I guess, much more than on this side.
So I got to ask, I imagine you played around with a few different vector databases and you had your fun with them. Do you have any advice or suggestions for us when we're going out there and messing with vector databases?
Well, I tried, I think, only two, because as it turns out, I knew the CEO of VV8. He was my friend at this point, and like, I literally just started using them. They are also open source. Like the other one I think I tried was Pinecone. Like it's fairly popular, I think, if you're on Twitter, in the Twitter space, like people mention it a lot. Viviate is like open source. I had friends there already. So like they even like, I want to make them, give them a shout out because they gave me to run everything on free. I haven't been paying anything for Viviate. So like for me, it was like a no-brainer.
Starting to see a pattern here, man.
Yeah. Well, when you know people, and that's not the whole story, by the way. We can go there a bit later, but like I got 16 A100s for free as well. So like that's the biggie. That's the biggie. Yeah. And more coming.
Yeah. No, tell me that because that sounds a lot bigger than the rig you've got right now.
Yes, and that's where I'm running everything that's serious. Like here locally, I'm just running some smaller jobs. Currently, they are actually running in the background somewhere in the cloud. I think it's like in Dallas, Texas or something. So I got them from Together AI. Like I also want to give a shout out to them because like they've been amazing. They've given me amazing support and like, I mean, giving me 16 A100s to train an open source project. That was amazing. They basically support these open source projects, and that's kind of a trend across the industry as well. So this should not come as a surprise if you're familiar with some of the work from EL3AI folks. Like Stability AI, for example, has been sponsoring a ton of projects. Especially if you're reading papers, you always see like in the appendix or like in the like acknowledgement section, sponsored by Stability AI. And so like you ask yourself, why are they doing that? And then the answer is they have a shit ton of compute that they cannot utilize themselves. And it's a good PR to just like rent it out and like have like in, it's almost like a, you're using that as a way to attract good research talent. So potentially hiring good PR, like, so there are benefits for them. It's not like they're just giving out stuff for free, right?
Yeah, 100%. And so you took advantage of it. Were there a lot of hoops that you had to jump through?
Not really. I already knew some people and like they actually gave talks on my Discord, which is now becoming like a big thing. Like I literally had amazing lineup of speakers over the last months. Like, I don't know, like you probably don't know James Betker. He's the main author of DALL-E 3. So like the recent text to image model from OpenAI. So he was there, like Tree Dog, who is the guy behind Flash Attention that basically made transformers go from like context length of like 4,228K. Like just improving the memory and the throughput. And then like, I don't know, like Niels Reimers, he's the director of machine learning at Cohere and a ton of other interesting people like from EL3AI elsewhere. Like, so like through those connections, like I managed to like find out about stuff, I guess that's it.
Yeah. And so what are you asking these people when they come through your Discord and what are you learning from them?
I mean, you learn something from everybody, right? Like, especially if they are talking about something where they're like an expert in that research, you can definitely pick up those types of like insights. And then depending on their position, you can then later like use that type of a connection to like, you help them, you know how it works. I mean, it's that type of a thing, but like, it's a good way to, for me to learn like, and just like gather interesting people. And I think it's a no brainer for me. That kind of replaced my YouTube efforts. Like back over the previous years, I was more like a guy that opens up a paper and then like hour and a half of long of going through math formulas, going through code. That was like a very, very niche channel. And that channel opened up a ton of serendipitous, interesting like opportunities for me just because various people were finding out about the stuff I'm doing and getting curious. So that was also a very good effort from my side.
Yes, we should probably mention that's how I found you. I saw that you had a whole section on MLOps. And so I was like, this is awesome. This is great because it's basically zero to hero for MLOps in like an hour or 3 hours. I can't remember. You did a few videos, right? There was like part one, part two.
Yeah, I did make a Jax zero to hero. That was a very good and full series. The thing with MLOps is I started and I kind of ended before even starting the series. So I didn't really like wrap it up the way I should have because I didn't have the time. Back then I was literally at the point where a ton of things was going on in the background and I was leaving DeepMind. That was like back, I think, January, February period or something. So like, unfortunately, that series is not complete. You probably saw the first one, which is a nice flashy video. And then like,
yeah, that's 100% what I saw. I thought there was a second one too, but I guess I was
maybe one more,
it.
But I, yeah.
maybe you said in the first one, all right, this is like the end of the first video. In the next video, I'm going to talk about this. So I just assume that you've made the next video. Turns out you didn't. You fooled us all.
Exposed.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's probably also worth mentioning that you worked at Microsoft, you worked at DeepMind, you were in London for a bit, and you left DeepMind. You were making YouTube videos, and now you're doing your own thing. You mentioned how you are getting a bunch of free stuff because you are a little bit of an influencer on LinkedIn. So if anybody, and Twitter, and all these fun social networks. So if anybody doesn't follow you that is listening, I encourage them to go out and give you a follow because what you share is highly valuable. And you also mentioned that you run into serendipitous moments because of putting yourself out there, whether it's on YouTube or on LinkedIn or Twitter or whatever it may be, or your Discord community. What are some of these serendipitous moments that you've had?
I really don't know where to start. Like, there's been so many interesting things that happened as a consequence of me being out there. And like, and I guess you also know that, like, maybe a recent thing that happened was that an amazing person that's like ex-Meta person with a ton of multilingual experience reached out to me, and that person is now my co-founder. I'm still not going to release, like, I'm not going to share much more than that right now because like everything is still in the early days, but like stuff like that or I don't know, like Eric Schmidt, ex-CEO of Google, starts following me on Twitter, and like that, all those things start opening up small doors, and then I get a shit ton of offers to work wherever, at NVIDIA. Recently, I even got an offer from OpenAI. Like, stuff like that happens because you're out there, and you're also doing the work. Because there is a lot of influencers nowadays, like the Thread Boys, and not only them, which are just talking. And they are basically just news reporters in the AI space. And for some reason, they think they are AI engineers or whatnot, but like none of them is building. And so I actually figured out that even if you have a much smaller audience, like even if you have like 2,000 or 3,000 on Twitter, but you're doing cool shit in the open source space, you're probably going to get much more amazing offers than somebody who has like tens of thousands, but is just like talking. Because then people like Andreessen Horowitz reach out to you. I actually talked with some of the guys who came to my Discord, and he told me that like Gary Tan literally DM'd him, the Y Combinator like president, because of some of his posts. And he's like, even like, he's not even an influencer. And then also like the Amjad, like the Replit CEO, DM'd him to hire him directly. So stuff like that happens. So to other people as well, to me as well. And like, I think that's what's amazing, because when you're building and being out there, that combination is kind of killer combination, because most people are doing either one or the other, right? And then you miss the benefits.
Yes, that is 100% what my feeling is too, that if you actually have something to say because of experience, as opposed to just breaking news or this
Justin
is, yeah, or gee, it's been 24 hours since GPT-4 has been released and we already see it's changing the world. Those kind of threads, I understand they don't add a lot of value, but the threads where you're breaking down some of the math or some of the papers or things that are really in depth when it comes to the level of sophistication, and you're doing it yourself in the background, so that's how you have the experience and the know-how to break it down, I think that gives you a lot more credibility.
And gives you more integrity and like just consistency between what you do and what you say. Although I'm not going to bash all of those people. Some of them do bring value, but to a completely different audience. And they know they're going to monetize on the current hype in AI, so like they just want to, which is, again, understandable. I'm not going to like say a bad thing about somebody because they want to boost up their Twitter or LinkedIn followers. But like, I cringe a lot though. Like, because
when you read my Twitter, is that what you cringe a lot when you see
like almost feels like ChatGPT generating some of those messages. And that's 100%. The part where I'm like, okay, like, oh my God, I started being much more concise since ChatGPT came out, by the way. Like I want to be as far as possible, both stylistically as well as semantically, away from what the average of humanity can output. And then, like, I don't know, like, that's an interesting thought.
So no emojis on your tweets anymore? No big words?
I'm getting allergic reaction to a lot of emojis. Like a couple of them is fine, but like I'm getting allergic reactions when I see too many. But again, that's just my style. I don't want to bash anyone.
It's funny you say that too, because I was listening to another podcast today and they were saying how when you are using, like as humans, it's really easy for us to sniff out if it was made by ChatGPT or just any of the GPTs. And what happens is it almost backfires on you, because if I'm reading your post and I can tell that it's obviously created by one of these models, I lose trust in you. And I think, yeah, this is great, but like you said, this is the average of humanity. If I have a good prompt, then I can also spit this out from GPT.
Yeah, there's a couple of contra arguments there, though. Like, first of all, people forget. So you will see somebody and like a month later, you'll see that same person posting something, you'll forget.
Unless you unfollow right away.
Yeah. And then the second thing, or block, whatever. I usually don't do that. Or the second thing is, like, you have to keep in mind that by the very nature of that being average, which is actually not, that's a bit of a like a misrepresentation of that output, but like that means they're targeting the biggest audience. And so just because you don't like it, nice, that means just you're not the audience for that person. So like there is that angle to it as well. And the thing that I kind of hinted is, even though I said it's average, it's not actually average, because even though the way how these models like train, right, like statistically on the, like a whole web corpus, oftentimes the authors of the paper deliberately inject much more scientific like data from archive, mathematics, all of that. And then you additionally have instruction tuning, which is again very high quality, curated by much more educated humans. And then so they're definitely not average in terms of whatever, like intellectually. And then there is the RLHF, the alignment part. It doesn't have to be RLHF, but and so all of those actually bring it up much, much more above. And we saw recent results. I think it was the AGI eval benchmark, where GPT-4 basically outperforms average human on SAT tests, which already for a population which is selected, right? It's not, that's not the average sample, people who do the SAT. So like it's definitely way above the average, the output of especially GPT-4. But anyhow, I'm digressing a bit.
Yeah, I think it's becoming very clear that when it comes to exams, a large language model, they're one step away from being able to do any kind of exam better than a human if they're not already beating it, right?
Exactly.
Like I think of my SAT scores and wow, they were so bad. And I struggled so much in high school trying to get those up. And so I'm like the below average on that.
Well, I mean, it's hard to compete with these models. First of all, you probably know that like the evaluation of these models should not be trusted, because oftentimes those SAT score like tests were already in the trained data.
Yeah.
And when you train the LLM on something, it's already seen something. It can basically memorize and just spits out the answer. So it's not necessarily the model reasoning it being smarter than an average human. So we have to be careful there as well. Like that's probably one of the hottest topics right now in the research community. Among one of the most important things to kind of tackle is better evals.
Yeah, we've done an evaluation survey with the MLOps community and we open sourced all the data for everyone to see. So anyone who took the survey can see all of the data of the other people that took the survey, or even if you didn't take the survey, you can see it. And what is fascinating is just how nobody really knows what the hell is going on with evaluations right now. I think that's the biggest takeaway. The TLDR is that we're just kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall.
Yeah, and like the last paper I saw did not help. I think it came from Together AI actually, where they showed if you take the benchmark, if you take the data from the test set, so something that you want to evaluate the model on, you just reformulate that data using, I think they use maybe even GPT-4. So like you just tell the model, hey, rephrase this. And then such reformulated text, you cannot now match it to the original data. Like if you use something like fuzzy deduplication or something, that text looks like it's original. And then if you train on that data, the model gets 100% on the original test. And so even though like, and so that means basically you cannot even catch, there's no way you can catch whether you've seen something in the training data because it can be just slightly reformulated and all of our hard-coded heuristics cannot catch that. And then you can kind of claim later high scores on an eval, even though that's not actually the case. And so ultimately what I see happening here is the only way we can eval these models properly is having crowdsourced ways of arenas where you're having multiple models competing and you're grading the outputs. And like, and just having like a, you know, like same with humans, you have to kind of build up the trust with a human being. It's going to be the same with models. Like we have to build like a societal trust into the model by the very nature of the model being out there and interacting with humans. That's how I think about evals right now, honestly.
Yeah, I've seen some companies also putting out new evaluation test sets that basically they curate and they have these high quality evaluation test sets in something like the financial domain or the tax domain. And so since they curate it, they can kind of assure that these models have not seen this type of evaluation test sets before because it's been behind closed doors. And then, yeah, and then you bring your model in and you can test against it. I don't know if that's the answer either, because it feels like, okay, that is good for the first time, but then what happens once the model's seen it? And then maybe you just have it, it gets out. And then once it's out, you got to continue to make new test sets, right?
And I think that's going to be the kind of the situation. And I, like, I'm glad you mentioned that because I recently read the Bloomberg GPT paper. And so Bloomberg basically has obviously a ton of financial data and they train on that data. And so like the thing with their data is it's chronological in nature, right? When you have such data set, then it's easy to take like future samples and just like use that to evaluate the model. So that's, I think, much more robust because we know we cannot really predict the models using like LLMs or whatever because there is a ton of it's an open system.
Exactly. Exactly. So, dude, tell me about the stuff that you're working on right now, because I know that you have Yugo GPT, which is, and I know you're a huge proponent of the languages and making sure that underrepresented languages get their shine when it comes to these large language models, which I think is awesome. But give me the breakdown. Like, how have you been spending your time besides inviting famous people on a Discord and getting reached out to by Andreessen Horowitz and the like?
Free GPUs. I'm glad you asked that because it nicely connects with to the previous topic of Bloomberg GPT and all of that. In a way, I'm going to get there. But like, what I'm like, so first of all, what's Yugo GPT? It's a LLM for HBS languages, and those are Serbian, Croatian, Bosnian, and Montenegrin. So that's where I'm from. I'm from Serbia originally, and I'm currently in Belgrade. Actually, that's the capital of Serbia. And so I'm training a first level, the first ever like large language model for these languages. The reason being is everybody's hyper obsessed with English. Like you just see all of the improvements, evals, everything in English, and it's going great. But like there is 196 or something countries out there which are maybe, well, some of them are using English as the first language, but you know what I mean. Like there is a ton of languages which are underserved. There is actually, I think, over 8,000 or 7,000 languages in the world. Although realistically speaking, maybe only 500-ish have like any decent amount of information and like some amount of million plus people speaking the language. Plus they have like, it's not only a verbal language. They also have a written, they have a scripture. They can actually log the things they're saying, right? And so I'm definitely bullish on that because me coming from Serbia and like this summer, actually, how this kind of whole thing was triggered, maybe I should start there, is I tried to fine-tune a Llama model, I think it was Llama 1 back then, on Serbian. And I realized I cannot even translate it properly into Serbian because I went to DeepL, which are the main commercial player, basically, next to Google Translate, and they don't even support any of the regional languages here. And they're kind of big player. They're already like, I don't know, like 300 million in funds or something.
Yeah, they raised a huge round, and I also think that they're based in Germany or Europe,
Köln.
Somewhere in Europe.
They're in Köln.
Yeah.
They're in Köln. That's like Western Germany, Nordrhein-Westfalen or something.
Yeah, they're close to me because I'm right outside of Frankfurt. And so,
yeah,
100%. So anyway, I didn't mean to derail you, but I also will say that I'm 100% on board with this because my wife is Basque. And you may or may not know that the Basque language
Northern Spain, right?
It's in, yeah, Northern Spain, and it is nothing like Spanish. It's not like Catalan where you can kind of decipher the words if you speak Spanish. It is in a league of its own, and there's a couple, maybe a million people. I don't know how many people are in the Basque country itself. I get the feeling that it's definitely over a million, maybe 2 million. And they have a rich history because there's been a ton of writing that goes back throughout time in Basque. But it is a very, very small portion of the world and a very, very, very small portion of the population. And I see it with my daughter because my wife's Basque, right? And so we speak Spanish and we speak English to my daughter, and we live in Germany. And we had to make the choice at some point whether or not we wanted to speak Basque with her. I obviously don't speak Basque, but it was at this certain point where it was like, oh, do we speak Basque with her? Do we not? It's not that utilized around the world, so she's going to be much better off learning Spanish. So we opted to speak Spanish to her. Now, I feel a little bit bad because we basically cut that, the propagation of that language within our family line. And so anyway, that's just a little bit of musings on the topic.
That's a great story. That's a great story. And I actually Googled where you were speaking. Like I see there is 2.1 million of
there
people.
We go.
That's the population, at least according to Google. That's still a respectable number. There are much smaller countries and languages.
All right, let's take a quick break from the episode and talk to you for a second about our sponsors of this show, OneDB, and what they've done with their newest LLM course. You can elevate your machine learning skills with Weights and Biases free course on training and fine-tuning large language models, LLMs, as they're called, out in the wild. You can learn from industry experts like Jonathan Frank from good old Mosaic ML, friend of the pod, Weiwei Yang, and Mark Serafin. And while you're doing it, learning from them, you can deep dive into the LLM fundamentals, advanced training strategies like LoRA and prompt tuning, all while getting your hands dirty and having some hands-on applications. This engaging course offers 37 lessons and over 4 hours of videos and a certificate upon completion. Enroll now to master LLMs and advanced techniques. Check out the link in the description to start your journey, and let's get back into the pod.
And so it is a big problem. And by the way, I think they're just like a completely different language family. They're not in the Romance language group, so that's the reason they're completely like alien languages. It's a similar thing in Hungary. They are just north from us, and like all of the countries here in this region are basically Slavic, so they come from the Balto-Slavic language group, and they are like Ungaro-Finnish. So it's like basically Hungary and Finland, which are completely like separated by Germany, Austria, whatnot. Like they have the common language that they are sharing. So that's kind of interesting dynamics. But anyway,
yeah,
going
so
back
makes
to the DeepL,
totally different, totally different. Uh-huh. And along the lines of that, and sorry to cut you off again, but
no worries,
because language fascinates me. Before I was in tech, I was teaching English, and I got really into languages. I also learned a few languages along the way, and when it comes to these different languages, especially with Basque, they have cave drawings that date back to before the Roman Empire. So it's like there is not a clear definition of which language Basque comes from, which I find absolutely incredible because some people say, oh, yeah, it's like the first language on the European continent. And then others say, well, slow your roll. I don't think it's that much. But it is really cool to think about because there isn't a language that is similar to it. You can't say, oh, it comes from this family tree, or, oh, it's a Romantic language or a Slavic language. It doesn't really have those roots. So it kind of puzzles the linguists in that regard.
Yeah, I actually have another example, Albanian, which are also neighbors here on the in the Balkan region. Nobody knows where the language stems from, and it seems they are the only like language in that language family, basically. So it's kind of, yeah, unclear.
It's so wild how that happens.
Yeah, I mentioned the DeepL, and the reason was like they don't support Serbian, and so I went to Google Translate. I translated some of the data into Serbian, but it turns out then I realized there is zero ecosystem for Serbian language. There are no evals. There are no LLMs I can pick up. Like the last LLM, quote-unquote LLM, was like 750 million parameters, GPT-2. And that's like, in ML world, that's like ancient history. Like that came out in 2018 or something, and it's super
was
small.
Was unusable. Yeah,
you can run literally 7B models right now on your laptop. So that's the state of affairs. And whereas we are running trillion parameter models in the servers, and so I realized, okay, there is a gap here, and also I'm selfish. I want to have something for my language. I want to be able to communicate with these models also in my native language, and so I started building various things. The first was the open source replication of the No Language Left Behind project by Meta. For context, that's a project where they basically created a machine translation system for 200 languages. 202 is the precise number. And so for any single combination direction, so that means over 40,000 directions is theoretically supported. I say theoretically because not all of those directions are obviously going to be high quality. And then they ended up they said they are open sourcing the models, but they did not. And people
in
tend to like
Meta
use these
fashion.
Words a bit. And not just Meta is actually probably one of the best companies out there in that regard. But like people are abusing the word open source to mean we released something. Releasing is not the same as open sourcing. So what they've done is they released the non-commercial checkpoints. So you cannot use them actually to do anything. So you can just look at them and play a bit with them, and that's it. That's where the fun stops. And so my idea was to, hey, let's build something that can actually be used for commercial use cases. And that was kind of how the whole multilingual journey for me started, that eventually ended up with me building the Yugo GPT.
And how many parameters, and how did you go about cleaning all this data? Did you get other people? Are there other researchers in this region that you could rely on, or was it you being a one-man band?
Again, Discord here helps. I built a community around this project as well, so some people are helping there with data. We have like this language champions doc where people can basically put their name next to some of the 202 languages that we want to support, and so it's kind of progressing. I did train the HVS model, so that's for the Serbian, Croatian, Bosnian languages. I'm currently almost done with the Slavic data processing, so I have like maybe 13 languages, so Russian, Polish, Czech language, and so that's kind of, it's stalled a bit because I'm now focusing mostly on Yugo GPT, but I'm going to wrap up the NLLB project as well. I'm gonna release those checkpoints and make them commercially available.
Wait, so explain to me what the difference between the No Language Left Behind and the Yugo GPT is.
So the first one, the NLLB, is basically machine translation system. And the second one, the Yugo GPT, is a large language model, which means it's much more flexible. It's not used only for translation. It can be used for whatever, summaries, for like document retrieval, for just like generation of text, if you want to do like greedy writing or whatnot, as you know, like what LLMs do in general. And like Yugo GPT is kind of a meme name, because like ex-Yugoslavia was like a thing, and we all still yearn for that. We have this nostalgic sentiment towards that old country, and so like it was like kind of play. Even though I only included four languages, which is not the complete Yugoslavia, so it might be a controversial meme. Like I kind of thought that the name is kind of cool, and it's also semi-pun, if that's even a word, because there was this very famous car called Yugo in like again in Yugoslavia, which was one of the worst cars in history. But again, it's literally one of the worst cars in history. If you Google it right now, you're going to find documentaries why people think it's the worst car in history. But like, despite that, people kind of love it. And it was like, you could see it all around the streets when we were growing up. And so like,
I definitely have heard of that car. And I know it's become one of those, like, there's a cult following around it because it's so bad. It's one of those things where, wow, this is so bad that we have to love it.
Exactly. And there are these memes, like, you don't even have to wear, like, seatbelts because, like, men drive, like, Yugos, and, like, you need to die, like, real men without the seatbelt in that car. Like, the car will survive, by the way. You're just going to die.
Oh, that's killer. And so now that project's finished, and what are the parameters on that, and how did you go about getting all that data?
So the Hugo GPT is actually running as we speak. It's humming on the 16M100s I mentioned before right now. So it's going to take, I think, at least 3-4 more days to get through the full epoch, which means one pass through the full data set. And after that, I might go multi-epoch just to get a lower loss, i.e. better quality. And that's going to be the base model. So it's still work in progress, actually. I'm planning on doing the instruction tuning afterwards as well. And I'll probably not do alignment at this stage, because like instruction tuning does the alignment in a way. It's just not as good as when you add RL component on top of it, but it's going to be good enough.
And do you see yourself just having this, are you going to host an API and let people play with it? Or are you just going to put it on Hugging Face and let people go about using it? What do you see this, like the future?
This one is going to be Apache 2. It's going to be open source model. I'm going to release this one, but it's not going to be nowhere as near good as I can make it. So there is a ton of ideas I have like on the backlog that I have to implement, like better tokenizer, because I'm currently using Llama tokenizer, which makes Serbian very verbose. And so it's much harder to train and do inference when you're using these suboptimal tokenizers. Ton more ideas of how I can make it better. So like my idea is to basically open source this checkpoint and then help businesses in the region actually run this and like make this like a business around it. So that's kind of how I'm thinking about this multilingual space.
Yeah, it feels like there's a lot of opportunity right now for the languages that are not as supported for anything, whether it's voice or text, like large language models, or text to speech or speech to text. All of that feels very unsupported. You have Whisper and it does have a bit of support, but I imagine when you really start digging in, it's just like what you found with the LLMs. It's okay, but not that good. And like you said, speaking of one of the telltale giveaways when you're using large language models, is all of a sudden your LinkedIn post or whatever you're doing get that you want, the output is very verbose. And so if you're talking about this tokenizer making it more verbose, it's like, interesting that is something that you're focusing on. But I went a little bit off the rails there, but I do think that there is a lot to be said for these languages that are not supported as commonly.
100%. And just a quick remark on the verbosity. It's more about the tokenizer. So basically what the LLM sees, it doesn't see the text, it sees these tokens. And so the only thing that's more verbose is going to be for the same sentence in English and in Serbian, the number of tokens that the model sees is going to be much bigger. So that's the verbose part. But when the model outputs the text that you actually as a human being read, that's going to be like as verbose as English. So it's not going to be more verbose in that sense. So like kind of maybe lower quality because of that. Just like a comment on that part.
Awesome. Yeah, really cool. And so you are doing all this, focusing a lot on the different pieces of languages, large language models, but I know that you also have done some cool stuff with vision and image models, and have you done something with a diffusion model maybe?
I did play with that as well. That was maybe last year. I also did recently, I made this Jarvis for images. You're probably referring to that one.
Yeah.
I basically made a local app that you can run on your system. And like all the models are open source. I'm using zero APIs, running everything locally. And like you can do very cool stuff. Like you're literally communicating with voice in real time. And then you say, hey, I'm looking for some image. And the model basically goes through your directory and finds that image. Or like images that have that type of a feature. For example, I want burgers. And then you say, hey, I want you to select maybe like sixth image or whatnot. And then the model selects the sixth image, and then you can manipulate the image. Then I say something like, can you segment the person from the image? Can you segment the clouds? And then I say, can you impede something instead of that? And I'm doing all of that locally through voice and manipulating the images and searching the images and all of that. So it's kind of wild that we can do that in 2023, honestly. because only a couple of years ago, it was science fiction.
Yeah, exactly. There is something that I want to pick your brain about when it comes to images and image generation and basically the generative AI with these image generation models. One thing that I had a buddy on here, Mikhail Eric, and he was talking about how he's trying to build a business off the back of an image generation. And what he feels like is that it had its moment, and that moment may have been probably like end of last year, beginning of this year. And a lot of people came into the space. There was a lot of energy and a lot of action around it. And then you had the ChatGPT moment that blew up, and people shifted their attention and they went and started building with that. And so it felt like there was a lot of building blocks and a lot of things that were left open and have not been properly optimized for if you're trying to build a business with these image generation tools or do anything in that space for that matter. Do you feel that way? Maybe you are a perfect example of that because you played with Jarvis for images, and then you said, okay, cool, this is great. Now I'm going to move on to Hugo GPT.
Yeah, yeah. So for me, this was more of a fun project while I was waiting for compute. That's actually the story. So like, there is definitely a ton of interesting opportunities all across the spectrum, across all of the modalities, any combination of those modalities. When I say modality, I mean text, image, video, audio, whatnot. Like, there is a ton of opportunities. But I think like vision, especially text to image, and even text to video right now, like, might be one of the most saturated markets. And also,
in how so? What do you mean?
Well, by that I mean like image is an image. If you manage to generate an image, and like anybody in the world can parse that and enjoy that image. Whereas with languages, there's going to be much more separation. So winners in the English space doesn't mean that those are going to be the winners in the, like, I don't know, like in like Vietnam, or winners in like Kenya or whatever. So like there's, I think, much more market opportunities for these because it's segregated. Language is kind of, it's a bigger space and also more open-ended. And I think it's going to be a ton more improvements that have to be done and will be kind of implemented over the next years. Whereas images are already kind of amazing. Like, I'm not saying it's going to be a ton of flexibility and steerability that you'll get from these tools. In the sense, if you saw the dragon, where basically you put a dot on the face of somebody and you can basically just move the dot and turn the person's face.
Dude, so cool. So
exactly.
Wild.
There is a ton of those things that can be done and improved in image, with images.
So aside from working on some of these languages, these underrepresented languages, what else are you excited about in this space? And what are some hard challenges that you think are worth tackling these days?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm excited about, I'm starting with the Balkan region just because I can easily validate the outputs from these models because I speak all of these languages. They are basically dialects. So I can call my, that's again a local meme, like everybody's a hyper polyglot here because everybody speaks five languages. As soon as you're bored, they're pretty much the same language. And so I don't know, after the Balkan region, I see a ton of opportunities, different markets where I'm thinking of tackling those markets. When it comes to technical challenges, there is a ton, because obviously there is not enough tokens in most of these languages. Man. To train like a large language model is going to be 7 billion or more parameters. Yeah. Just if you take a look at the chinchilla scaling laws, which was a paper that came out actually from DeepMind like last year, maybe March. And that law basically tells you, I mean, law, quote unquote, it's not a hard physical law, but it tells you how many tokens you need to have per parameter. And that number turns out to be maybe 20 tokens per parameter. So you can then count easily how many tokens you need in a language for a given size of the model. And that's kind of lower bound because people are now pushing into these data saturated regimes. So like, I don't know, like Llama 1 was maybe 140 tokens per parameter. So it's like 7x that what Chinchilla proposed. So like, that's a TLDR for saying you need a shit ton of data that most of these languages don't have. And so you have to be creative about how do you take something that's a powerful reasoning engine, maybe in English, and do the so-called language adaptation by taking a smaller subset of tokens and teaching that model how to speak that language while preserving the original reasoning capabilities, mathematics, knowledge about the facts, about the world, and just teaching it how to say that same thing in a different language. That's kind of the main challenge. And maybe a quick plug here, I'm definitely looking for a technical co-founder, someone who knows how to build these systems and who has ideally like a publishing, like a track record already in the space, building large scale systems. So yeah.
Yeah, doing what? Like hosting systems or building
training.
Them?
Okay. Training these systems. So like somebody who knows how to train LLMs at scale, who knows how to deal with all the issues that come up with scale, and ideally some experience with multilingual space, understanding the difficulties you end up with collecting data in different languages, all of that's kind of bonus type of an experience.
Well, yeah, and it feels like for me, the pieces where you start to get to languages that are not with the alphabets that we're used to, that is a fascinating problem too. I imagine that just adds a nice little spice to the mix. Even if there are the tokens, I understand that there's probably a ton of tokens out there in Japanese per se, but it's got to be a bit different because of the characters.
Exactly. And that is the case. It depends how you train your base model. So for example, Llama deliberately like used mostly English or code, whatnot, but like mostly English when it comes to languages. And so when you attempt to tokenize some of these maybe Eastern Asia languages, like some of the Chinese languages like Mandarin Chinese or whatnot, like you're going to end up either having these so-called Ankh tokens, the unknown tokens, or just like a ton of verbosity. And like it's not going to end up learning well. So you have to train the tokenizer from scratch. And some of the models, like there's been a ton of work in this space as well, like Bloom being one of prominent examples, where this was from the Big Science project, where they built this 176 billion parameter model for a ton of languages. And its underlying tokenizer had like a vocabulary of 250,000 tokens. And so it covered both Chinese scripture as well as Japanese kanji and like Korean and like Western languages, quote unquote. And so like, yeah.
Wait, so you are obviously showing that you know how to build these large language models. You're training YugoGPT right now. Why do you feel like you need a co-founder that has these experiences also, or has this skill?
Because like obviously when starting a company, you have like, I'm a very generalist person, like, so I know a lot of stuff that's not necessarily just building models, and ultimately I'll likely end up not having the bandwidth to completely train these models. That's one thing. Plus I don't have a publishing record in this space, so there is definitely 100% better people than I am in this particular niche of just like building these systems, because that's something that they've maybe done a PhD in, and then they've been doing only that for years. Whereas like I started, my journey kind of started with electronics, then I pivoted into software engineering at Microsoft, then machine learning, then I was like all around machine learning, computer vision, NLP, RL, like everything. And then I kind of converged over the last couple of years towards NLP space and maybe like multimodal. But you get what I'm saying. Like I've been all around the place, and while I've been exploring and doing this breadth research, somebody has been doing only this. So like I definitely am looking for such a person who like has both the entrepreneurial capabilities and aspirations, and also knows how to build these systems at scale. And that's like the only thing they've been doing over the last years or whatnot.
That hyper-focused. I have a lot of respect for people that can stay hyper-focused, because I'm not that person. I, as you can see, I got a guitar in the background. I've also got a piano around. I like talking to people on podcasts. I like learning about so many different things. And my hat is tipped to the people that say, you know what, I really like doing this one thing, and I'm going to go as deep as possible on this one thing, because they become obsessed in a way.
Yeah, but I think you might have a wrong assumption there. Like some people are just, it's natural for them not to be broad. So for me, for example, I also, like I played guitar for 3 years in a school, and then I was doing electric guitar for a couple of years. And like, I speak five languages with varying degrees of like proficiency. And so like, I've been doing a ton of stuff, and also like calisthenics, I trained six martial arts. I've been all around the place.
Nice.
I've been all around the place as well. Like that was my childhood. So like I kind of grew up coming to like faculty and being, okay, I've done a lot of cool stuff, but like while I was doing all of this, somebody has been programming and doing competitive programming since they were seventh grade. And like, I'm missing out, like I'm falling behind. And then I had to catch up. And then slowly I realized the thing is, like, you have to focus because even if you're just doing languages, if you want to be like a polyglot that speaks 20 languages, if you don't use two of those languages for like 3 years, for whatever reason, it's already weaker. It's not going to disappear. Yeah. But then you don't feel as good because like things are constantly just like being eaten by the entropy. And so yeah. I feel that just being hyper focused on something now in this point of my life is very important, because otherwise I feel I can never become the best at something unless I artificially focus myself. Because naturally, as I said previously, like I'm really, if you just gave me the freedom to do whatever I want and I was not obsessed about making something and succeeding as one thing, I would be doing everything. I literally mean that. Like I can imagine myself in a parallel life being a travel vlogger, just eating food, going to hotels, like exploring the world, learning languages, completely different from what I'm currently, like this hyper-focused tech guy who is just like reading papers, building stuff, sitting at the computer for like 16 hours a day. So it was a hard decision for me in particular as well.
Well, talk to me about your decision to leave DeepMind, and especially you're going to be looking for a co-founder. You mentioned before that you already have one other co-founder and you're looking for another co-founder that is a bit more hyper-focused on this.
Yeah.
That person presumably is getting those offers that you were talking about from OpenAI and Google and Meta and all that fun stuff. Why would someone want to pass up on the big payday of working for one of these big tech companies and join a startup?
That's a good question. I get the TLDR will be, I am also refusing some of those offers. I'm also getting offers from all of those companies. And like, so
exactly.
There must be something.
That's almost like what I want to hear about is like, what is your rationale? Because I know that you had to have strong conviction in yourself and what your next step is to say, okay, cool. I've done the Microsoft thing. I've done the DeepMind thing. And now I want to do my thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the answer, however you want to put it, well, first of all, I'm very entrepreneurial. So for me, this was a natural path. Before I even started working at Microsoft, I knew I'm going to leave after 2 years. It turned out to be a bit longer because like pandemic struck and so things kind of got out of schedule. And similar thing for DeepMind. And so for me, it was natural that I knew I wanted to have this high agency role where I'm just building the stuff I want and I'm leveraging all of my skills, which were not always used inside of corporations. So for example, like thanks to some of the blogs and stuff I put out there for landing a job at DeepMind, I literally had over 20 new joiners at DeepMind like reaching out and thanking me for like helping them land a job. And like I get zero financial gain for that. Like they didn't give me any type of award because that's not part of my role as a cog in the system. And so I'm thinking, man, if I was in a startup and if I like literally hired 20 smart people, like I would be so much richer already. So like,
you'd be a travel blogger, dude.
Retired. Financially also like the expected value of me pursuing a startup route right now is so much higher than me getting whatever at like any of these companies, even if the compensation is like million or I know this firsthand, like for OpenAI, some of them literally got 10 million packages. But even for those types of like, if you know you're like outlier in terms of determination, in terms of like skills, whatnot, like your expected value is much more than 1 million. Like if I'm just shooting for 1 million, I can go and enjoy the comfortable life at the corporation and climbing up my ladders and doing the low agency jobs. Because I honestly think all of those are low agency like jobs. You cannot do whatever you want. You're still an employee under some manager. You still have to restrict yourself to do something. When you build your own thing, then you can, if you are the founder, you have much more freedom. Maybe at one point, investors and board members start like constraining you somewhat, but like still, it's much higher agency than being like a L4, L5 engineer at Google or Meta or whatnot.
Facts. that is
It's simple. It's simple. Like if you're optimizing for wealth, the riskiest thing you can do right now is going the safe route of being in big tech. Like worst thing that can happen in 2 years' time, I raised like 50 million. I like built a team from scratch. Like I oversaw an organization. I built it up. I failed. And like I'm going to get fired as an L7 like at Meta or Nvidia. Like, you know what I mean? And I don't think that's going to be the outcome because I don't plan on coming to big corporations. But like that's kind of the worst thing that can happen financially for me. And so I don't see from that standpoint, I really don't see any downsides. Like I only see me missing out now when I'm 29 and not pursuing something that's crazy and long-sighted.
Yeah.
Dude, I love it. You inspired me, man. I'm like, fuck, let's go get it, baby. Let's do it.
Exactly.
Not that I have any offer from Meta or Google hanging around in my inbox, but even if I did, I'd say no after listening to that.
I mean, the thing is, there is just so many misconceptions about the salaries in big tech. Like, you hear somebody having like somebody's in Bay Area and they have like 700,000 compensation. Nice. Okay. And then subtract the taxes. And then you end up with like half of that or something. And then you're like, okay, 350. Okay. And then you have to pay for like a monthly rent of like, if you have kids, you're going to be paying 4,000 or something. And then you have kids, you have to pay for medical or whatnot. You end up with saving maybe, I don't know, if they save 200K or 100K a year, that's great. And so like, it's not that great when you actually subtract the costs. And if you have children, like you're actually not that well off. And so, I don't know. It sounds much better when you hear 700,000, but like, I don't know. It's still kind of low league when it comes to potential outcomes financially.
Yeah. After you do all the math, if you are forced to be in San Francisco, of course, if you have the luck and you say, all right, I have that pay, but I'm in somewhere like Thailand, then you're living large. But I don't know many researcher jobs that are fully remote, 100% remote, where you can hang out in Thailand and be training the models across the pond.
And also, if you end up in that type of a deal, you're almost certainly going to get a lower wage, almost certainly, unless you negotiate something, a special deal. For example, I have a friend here from Serbia who literally has San Francisco salary in Belgrade because he was part of the founding. He helped found the local office. And so those people who like help open up a branch of a company in some other country can end up having the highest salary in the sense of geographical, in the sense they are receiving Bay Area salary in some X part of the world. So that's kind of a cool deal. But again, it just depends on what are you aiming for, because it's still just a salary. You're still, no matter what you do, you can do some crazy shit. You can optimize, like, I don't know, you can save Google 5% storage like across the whole planet, which is like amazing contribution. And you'll maybe get promoted 2 levels, whatever. Like, who cares? Like, you got 2 levels. For that, if you had your own business, you would now be like a multi-deca millionaire or like whatever. Like, so I don't know. It's dampening your outcomes when you're in a corporation.
Dude, I love it. I think this is a perfect place to end it because I'm going to take this inspiration and I'm going to go and do some shit. I don't know what I'm planning on doing for the rest of the day, but whatever I'm going to be doing it with vigor. That is for sure.
I'm going to be playing guitar like Hendrix by the end of the evening. Like,
there ain't no more fucking around, baby. I am doing this. I just got amped. Let's go. All right. Well,
this has been an absolute pleasure. I'm super excited for what you are doing. And for anyone, I said it before, but for anyone that wants to follow along on your journey, follow you on Twitter and LinkedIn. It's great to have you pop up on my feed. And also, I would also say join your Discord if they want to hear some of the great speakers that you get on there. And yeah, man, thanks.
Thanks a lot. Demetrius, I really, really enjoyed this one.
Ops, you have to immerse yourself in the MLOps content. The best way to do it is to subscribe to the MLOps Community Podcast. So, good luck and keep learning.